Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along tonight, folks. It's great to be back at the Gallipoli Club in Sydney with the exhibition here of some of the fallen from and those who survived and won VCs during the famous Battle of Lone Pine 100 years ago. So it's great to be back here. It's great to have Michael Sexton back at the Sydney Institute. I think it's about his fourth appearance on tonight on the occasion of the publication of his memoir, On the Edges of History. Now, Michael Sexton is well known to many of you, but I will introduce him briefly. He has degrees in law from the Universities of Melbourne and Virginia. After some years as an academic lawyer and writer, Michael commenced practice as a barrister in the mid-1980s, taking silk in 1998. He currently holds the position of Solicitor General for New South Wales. He's been chairman of the New South Wales State Rail Authority and a board member of the New South Wales Public Transport Authority, the New South Wales State Library, the Sydney Writers Festival, and the University of Technology. And he's the author of a number of books on legal text and other books and histories, some of which he's addressed the Sydney Institute concerning. And tonight he's back to talk On the Edges of History, following the publication of Michael's book, On the Edges of History, a memoir of law, books and politics. Michael Sexton, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Thanks, Gerard. Well, the book that Gerard's just held up is really an attempt to look at some of the fragments of history in Australia over the post-war years, ones in which I've either been personally involved or that I've written about, or both in some cases. I was born in 1946, so my life has run really at the same time as those post-war years. The book starts, in fact, with my present role as the New South Wales Solicitor General, but then it goes back to the start and looks at my family background, including the adventures of my great-uncle, Jim Mooney, who was one of the organisers of William Lane's expedition to Paraguay to found New Australia in the wake of the strikes of the early 1890s, when a lot of the organisers of those were completely disillusioned by their failure. Most of those settlers, including Lane himself and Mooney, eventually returned to Australia, although there are still some descendants of the original group in Paraguay. It might be, of course, that this is an example of rather quixotic or eccentric behaviour that's run through the family over some of those years. I grew up in Melbourne in the 1950s, but in a Catholic family that was not a supporter of Mr. Santa Maria's movement. It's a relatively unusual situation and made us slightly, I think, outsiders in what was otherwise a very close-knit community, a world within a world at that time. In his extremely good new biography of Santa Maria, Gerard places the greatest responsibility for the Labor split in 1955 on Labor leader Evatt. That's no doubt correct, but Santa Maria nevertheless played a very considerable role in those events, and my objection really to his part in modern Australian history is his contribution to breaking the electoral cycle so that there was a period of one-party government for 23 years, and irrespective of one's political views, it seems highly undesirable that you would have that situation, and it's responsible for a lot of economic and political problems in Australia, and perhaps that still today there are still some legacies from that period. I spent the second half of the 1960s at Melbourne University Law School. Jared and I were direct contemporaries, but we didn't meet during that period. I think he was heavily involved in political activities, and most of my time was spent on the tennis court, I think. But as Jared would recall, Melbourne University, and particularly the law school, contrary to a lot of suggested reports in later years, was very far from a hotbed of student radicalism. Many of the law students wore jackets and ties, and they had correspondingly conservative political views. Almost all the students that I knew were in favour of the war in Vietnam, as was at that time a majority of the community. I'll say something more about Vietnam a little later, but support for the war in the general community didn't really begin to fall away until the late 1960s, when it was clear that the conflict was going badly for Americans and their allies. I may have had that slightly radical political view, but I certainly dressed quite conservatively, like most of my colleagues in the student body. After law school, I went to work for one of the justices of the High Court, Sir Edward McTiernan, and this required a move from the quasi-European world of Melbourne to the more Australian style of Sydney. This may not necessarily be a compliment, I might say, but they're very different cities, and having come to Sydney, I suppose, in my early 20s, I was struck very much by the differences between the two major cities in the country, and I've talked a little about that in the book during this period. When McTiernan went to sit as a judge on the Privy Council in London in 1972, I went with him, but I didn't come back to Australia at that time. I didn't abandon him, and in one sense we'd agreed before leaving what would happen, because I was due to finish up really those positions at that time, and still for associates people would stay for 12 or 18 months and really seldom longer with the judge in question. So I stayed in Europe, and then I went to the University of Virginia Law School in the US. In one fragment of history, I was working in Washington in mid-1973 in a building a block from the White House, while inside the White House, President Nixon was desperately trying to stem the tide of congressional investigations arising out of the Watergate burglary and some other scandals concerning the presidency. We always thought that we might see a huge cloud of black smoke rising over the White House as documents were being disposed of. And it was an extraordinary time in American politics, and I can recall watching in the evenings with my American colleagues the broadcasts of the congressional hearings as they unfolded day by day. When I came back to Australia in late 1974, I went to work in the Federal Attorney General's Department in Canberra, but in early 1975, I moved into the old Parliament House on the staff of the Attorney General, Kev Enderby, who'd just taken over that role because Lionel Murphy had been appointed to the High Court. The book recounts my personal experiences with the tumultuous events of that year, culminating in the removal of the government by Sir John Kerr on 11 November 1975. In 1979, I had a book published on the Whitlam period under the rather forlorn title of Illusions of Power. I was, of course, sympathetic to the government because of the way it had been removed from office, but it was impossible to discuss some of the events of that period, the Loans Affair being an example, without being highly critical of Whitlam and some of the other ministers. Whitlam made it clear to me that he resented some of these criticisms, and I was not especially popular with many of his admirers on the Labor side of politics. I think I give one example of the book of a personal encounter with Whitlam shortly afterwards, which was far from pleasant, and indeed rather frightening in its own way. As to the way in which the government was removed from office, I know there's been an enormous amount written on this, and there's going to be some more written as well. Paul Kelly and Troy Bramston have got a book coming out in November on the subject, but I expressed the view in the book that Kerr's failure was not to warn Whitlam of what he was contemplating. This wouldn't have been a particularly pleasant conversation either. But if he'd taken the high ground in this way, the outcome would have been quite different for Kerr, and he would not have been destroyed in the way that he ultimately was. I doubt that there was any likelihood of Kerr himself being dismissed, but even if that had happened, I don't think it could have happened. He would have been a hero, of course, and not a villain. We know now that Kerr had been considering what might happen as early as August 1975, and that he'd been advised for some time preceding the government's removal by Sir Anthony Mason, one of the justices of the High Court. Perhaps one of the most extraordinary performances in modern Australian history, I think Sir Anthony Mason's conduct in 1975. I'm not suggesting that Kerr wasn't in a difficult position or that he was the instigator of the crisis. The instigator was obviously Malcolm Fraser and his colleagues, who couldn't wait until the next election, when the government would certainly have been very soundly defeated at the polls. But I think Kerr mishandled his role as Governor General and paid a very high price for that, of course, in the long run. Illusions of Power was reissued with a new final chapter in 2005 to mark the 30th anniversary of November 1975. Its original launch in 1979 was by Bob Hawke, who was then the president of the ACTU. And the launch in 2005 was done by Paul Keating. So I think I can claim the rare distinction of having the same book launched by both Hawke and Keating, who, of course, by 2005 were on far from friendly terms with each other. In 1981... Lawrence Maher and I brought out a book on the legal profession, The Legal Mystique. In many ways, we're not saying anything particularly dramatic. For example, we made the point that although courts tended to portray their decisions as inevitable, it was often just as open to find for the other side, and the subjective views of the judge sometimes played a role in all of this. So the book provoked quite a bit of anger in the legal profession, particularly on the part of some judges, not helped by a front-page story in the Australian Financial Review about the book under the headline, Why Judges Are Biased. It wasn't actually the point of the book. This was Paddy McGuinness's headline, and I still blame him for a lot of the trouble that all this caused. The next book provoked rather more controversy, War for the Asking, Australia's Vietnam Secrets. It dealt with the period in late 1964 and early 1965 when the American and the Australian government effectively made the decisions that led to the Vietnam involvement over the next decade. It was based on highly classified material that had never up to that time been made public. Publishers and I were well aware that the book could, and almost certainly would, be the subject of a court restraining order if it was publicised in advance. So it was put into bookstores without any advance publicity, and news stories published on the morning that it became available. There was an investigation in Canberra into all this, but ultimately the decision was made that no action would be taken. In a sense, this was the time of the Fraser government, and realistically their interest in going back and defending perhaps the decisions of the Menzies government wasn't at the forefront of their minds. There were a lot of other current political issues that they had to deal with. But the point of the book was to show that far from being pressured into the decision to commit Australian troops by the Americans, that the Menzies government actively sought an invitation from Washington to take part and in fact exerted what pressure it could on the administration in Washington to step up the conflict in Vietnam. Now, opinions can differ as to the merits of these decisions, but it seems to me that it was clear at the time, not just in hindsight, that the war could not be won by the politically limited means that were available to the Americans. And so the decisions really have to be looked at, I think, in that light. In many ways, it was a very cynical decision by the Australian government. At least the Americans wanted to try and preserve South Vietnam as an independent country, but the Australians really were indifferent, I think, to the result and to the South Vietnamese. Their only interest was in having an insurance policy with the Americans that could be called in if it was ever necessary. Those books were written while I was an academic in the law school at the University of New South Wales, but in 1984 I left the law school for the bar, where I was to practice for the next 14 years. A lot of my practice was in media law, and my largest client was the ABC, although I acted for other defendants and for many plaintiffs in that area over the years. In the case of the ABC, I spent a lot of time at the studios that were then in Gore Hill, not at Ultimo, particularly providing legal advice in advance for Four Corners programs. There's lots to be said for trying to deal with legal problems in defamation and contempt prior to publication in an effort to avoid costly and time-consuming litigation after publication. Sometimes litigation occurred anyway, but not always, and usually not. Perhaps the most famous of the Four Corners programs from those years was Chris Masters' Moonlight State in 1987 that dealt with police corruption in Queensland. Set off a chain of events that eventually led to the collapse of the Bjelke-Petersen government. In addition to television programs, I provided legal advice on a lot of books, films, radio programs, even music recordings on occasions. Those experiences with media law made me particularly conscious of the importance of freedom of speech in Australia, and I've discussed in the book how successfully or otherwise this value is maintained by the laws of defamation and contempt. There's obviously room for a lot of debate about this on that subject. And in recent years, I've had a lot to say, too much no doubt for many people, on the subject of Section 18C of the Federal Racial Discrimination Act, which, quite wrongly in my view, makes publications unlawful on the basis that they're offensive or insulting to some groups in the community. Another large component of my practice, seemingly having no relation to media law, was acting for government regulatory bodies, and particularly the Healthcare Complaints Commission, which deals with complaints about medical practitioners in New South Wales. So there's some material in the book about the world of medicine. The best known of the cases, I suppose, that I was involved in was that relation to Dr. Geoffrey Edelston, which continued for the best part of a decade in different courts and tribunals. He was struck off the roll of medical practitioners in the late 1980s and eventually went to prison in the early 1990s because of two matters that had emerged in the course of the hearings before the medical tribunal. During that period, I also spent 18 months in the Chelmsford Royal Commission, which investigated the use of deep sleep treatment in the Chelmsford Private Hospital on Sydney's Upper North Shore. This is a rather harrowing exercise, my only real exposure to the problems of mental illness, and I think everyone who was involved in the Royal Commission found it quite a grueling experience, really. I dealt in the case in the book with some of the cases that seemed to me to be the most interesting ones that I had at the bar. I won't go into most of them because I don't have time, but one of my favourites is a case that had its origins in the Profumo affair in England in 1963. And sitting in the front row here is Winston Redford, who was the instructing solicitor in that case. This was a wonderful English scandal with sex, spies, lords and ministers all involved. It cost the Secretary of State for War, John Profumo, his job, and perhaps the Conservatives the next election in 1964. The only person who faced criminal charges out of all of this was Stephen Ward, who was charged with living off the earnings of prostitutes. Ward took his own life in the course of the trial before the jury's verdict was returned. Geoffrey Robinson had a book published in about 18 months ago about why Stephen Ward was innocent, in Geoffrey's view. Well, there's certainly plenty of room for argument there. But a book published in 1987 and serialised in the Sunday Times in England and the Australian in this country suggested that Ward had been framed by the police officers in charge of the case. The second in charge officer was someone called John Burrows, who'd later emigrated to Australia and worked with the Australian Federal Police. He became something of a hero because he disarmed a man armed with a knife at Sydney Airport who was holding a young girl hostage. So I appeared with Terry Tobin, QC, for Burrows in proceedings that were commenced in the New South Wales Supreme Court in relation to these publications. And my research has led to an intricate knowledge, subsequently of no use whatsoever, of English politics in the early 1960s. Our opponents, whose clients obviously had much greater resources than ourselves, spent some time in England on a similar exercise, so we were suitably envious. Ultimately, however, the case was settled without going to trial, and Mr. Burrows received a considerable sum of money from the defendants. We were looking forward to the trial, I don't know about Winston. Tobin and I were looking forward to the trial because we thought it'd be impossible for the other side to prove the truth of the allegations, and that could be the only defence in such a case. But naturally, the interests of the client had to come first, and a reasonable settlement of an action is always better than a trial in any event. During my early years at the bar, I spent quite a bit of time in the world of politics on the Labor side. I was a delegate to state and national conferences, member of policy committees in the New South Wales branch, including being chairman of the Defence and Foreign Affairs Committee. Spent quite a bit of time in meetings with Hawke, Hayden, Keating, and I've expressed some views in the book as to the differences between these very different characters. Provided some legal and other advice to Bob Carr over the time that he was leader of the opposition in New South Wales. And I was frankly interested in a political career in the Senate rather than the House of Representatives. But as for many of my contemporaries, that didn't happen. I don't have any regrets about spending some time in that world, although all I can say is that, as you would have observed from recent events, it's no place for the faint-hearted. One of the most interesting exercises, though, from that time was in 1988, when I went with the former South Australian Premier, Don Dunstan, to Fiji to compile a report for the Labor's National Executive in the aftermath of the coup in 1987 that removed the elected government. Dunstan was a remarkable character, and when, according to people who were there at the time, when the Premier's Conferences, as they were then called, were held in Canberra in the 1970s, the observers of those events often remarked that he was the most impressive of all the politicians present, state and federal. So we spent a week together travelling around Fiji, talking mostly with members of the deposed government because the new government had placed a ban on their members speaking to us. We were followed during this time by the police, who were perfectly reasonable, and in one sense it was meant we could never miss a connection or miss a flight because they would ensure that we'd be on it. So I don't have any complaints. It's slightly disconcerting. And in the evenings over dinner, I heard many fascinating stories from Dunstan, the worlds of law and politics that have never been put into the public domain, and with very good reason, if I may say so. I did form the view that it would take a long time for the scars to heal from the events of 1987 in Fiji, and the truth is that in many ways that's never really happened. And of course, a lot of the Indian population left and came to Australia and New Zealand, with having quite a dramatic effect on Fiji. In the early 1990s, I was a member of the National Committee of the Australian Republican Movement. I don't think that I'm noted for excessive modesty, but there's no shortage of powerful egos in this group, including Malcolm Turnbull, who was the chairman. I'd first met Malcolm in the late 1970s when he was working at the Bulletin. There are some references to him in the book. If I'd known about last week, I would have put in more references. but on that committee, there was, in addition to Malcolm, there were people like David Hill, Donald Horne, Tom Keneally. Not easy to get a word in at those meetings, I can tell you. But ultimately, the push for Republic, of course, failed at the plebiscite in 1999, largely because of divisions on the Republican side. I've explained in the book that I myself have always favoured the so-called minimalist solution to this question, where you, in effect, substitute a president for the Governor-General, having essentially the same role, with the president being appointed by the federal parliament. But there's obviously support in the community for the proposition that the president should be a product of popular election. I think it's a mistake because it has the potential to set up a rival to the Prime Minister, and that could lead to, I think, quite significant political problems. Quite apart from the likelihood now, I think, that an elected president is likely to come from the ranks of game show hosts or ageing movie stars. Who knows? So I'm not sure how that problem can be solved, and I think it's rather affected my own enthusiasm for the Republican movement, but it's not it's not high on anyone's political agenda, I think, at the moment. One of the difficulties with the constitutional change that would be required to become a republic is that a number of people would like to use the opportunity for a whole series of other constitutional changes, which would make it much more difficult, in my view, to have the republic approved in any event. But there's other objections to some of these ideas. Over the years, I've written quite a bit about proposals for a Bill of Rights in Australia, and I've dealt with this again in the book, my objection being that a Bill of Rights, whether constitutionally entrenched or simply a statute, is simply a transference of economic, social and political questions to unelected judges. Now, I can say I think that some of my best friends are judges, but it's a separate question as to whether those issues should be handled by courts as opposed to the parliament. They don't become legal issues by being handed over the courts. All that happens is that social, economic and political issues are decided by the courts instead of by the parliament. So it's already happened in Victoria and the ACT. And at one time, almost a decade ago, it seemed that a Bill of Rights would be enacted in most of the states and at the federal level. This push was successfully resisted, but the proponents of a Bill of Rights are relentlessly active. They include most of the legal professional bodies, many academic lawyers, staff of human rights organisations. Most of these persons, I might note, publicly funded to carry out these campaigns. And the problem is that there's really no countervailing force to this dedicated group who spend so much time lobbying governments around the country. There's a proposal that a Bill of Rights be enacted by the new Queensland government, And needless to say, it's been flooded with submissions from these groups advocating the introduction of such a statute. A cynic might say that these lawyers have a financial interest in its enactment, and it's true that a Bill of Rights would generate substantial litigation, but the groups that I've just mentioned actually have a strong belief that the courts are better qualified than the parliaments to decide the important questions in our society. Now, it's obvious that I don't agree with that, but it's easy to point out the deficiencies of a parliamentary democracy, but as Churchill was inclined to say, that's only until one considers the alternatives. In 1998, I took up this post of New South Wales Solicitor General, remaining a barrister, but with only one client, the New South Wales government. The post seems to have been mysterious to many people, so I might just say something very briefly about it. Its very title is in some ways confusing, because it's a role for a barrister, but one is called the solicitor. Make what you will of that. The office had its origins in the England of the 15th century, and still in England and in Australia, the Solicitor General is the second law officer of the Crown, the Attorney General the first law officer. It's a Commonwealth Solicitor General, one for each state and one for each of the two territories. In Britain, the Solicitor General is a member of the House of Commons and so a politician as well as a lawyer like the Attorney General. The Solicitor General in all of those jurisdictions is essentially the government's chief legal advisor. In theory, of course, that's the role of the Attorney General, but it's now unusual to have an Attorney General who's practiced law for any length of time before going into politics, and their electoral and parliamentary duties leave very little time for attending court or working on advices. So the Solicitor General appears in court in major cases for the state of New South Wales, particularly, but not only, the constitutional cases in the High Court, Court of Appeal, Federal Court. And in addition, a major part of the job is dealing with requests for legal advice from the Attorney General, other ministers, departments, government agencies. Often a question perhaps of statutory interpretation, for example, whether a government body has the power to do something that it wants to do. But almost any area of law can arise: contracts, negligence, taxation, charitable trusts, mining law. It might be thought that the constitutional cases in the High Court reflect a struggle over powers between the Commonwealth and the states, but generally not now. It was so for some decades after the war, but the combination of the Commonwealth's financial dominance and the High Court's expansive reading of Commonwealth powers under the Constitution has made those contests largely a thing of the past. The only real exception in recent times was the challenge by all the states to the Howard government's Work Choices legislation in 2006. The challenge was rejected, as any first-year law student could have predicted, but this was a political, not a legal exercise. Most constitutional cases now involve a challenge to federal or state legislation by individuals complaining about the impact of legislation on themselves, often in areas of law enforcement, for example, anti-terrorism legislation. And in those circumstances, it's usual to find the Commonwealth and the states, represented by their various solicitors general, all in agreement at the bar table in the High Court, supporting the relevant legislation. Occasionally there's a breakdown in this united front, but not very often. When I took up this position, I didn't imagine that I'd be spending a great deal of time in criminal law, but it comes up frequently, and I've been involved in the appeal courts, not at trials, in some very well publicised cases in New South Wales over recent years. Quite a number of those involved the relatively small group of persons who were sentenced before real life terms were introduced in 1989, but whom the government was determined not to release from prison. So challenges were mounted to the legislation implementing this government decision by Alan Baker and Kevin Crump, who'd abducted Virginia Morse from a family property in Western New South Wales late in 1973 and finally killed her. And another challenge was mounted by two of those convicted of killing Janine Balding in 1988 after she'd been abducted from a railway station. All of these cases went to the High Court, but all of the challenges were ultimately unsuccessful. Two other appeals in which I was involved for the Crown that received a great deal of publicity were those involving Kathleen Folbig and Bruce Burrell. Mrs. Folbig was convicted of killing her four children in 2003, and the question was whether those deaths could have been classified as cot deaths. Mr. Burrell was convicted of kidnapping and murdering Kerry Whelan in 1997 after she was last sighted leaving a car park in Parramatta. The body was never found, but Burrell's conviction was upheld on appeal, and so was Mrs. Folbig's. In recent times, in New South Wales, the Independent Commission Against Corruption has generated a great deal of legislation and litigation. I've been involved in two cases this year in the High Court involving the ICAC. The first was a challenge to the cancellation of a number of coal licences following hearings last year that I imagine everyone remembers, by the ICAC as to how those licences were awarded. Ooh. Can we hear? I'll just pop that up. Yeah. It seems to have collapsed around. Okay. That challenge was unsuccessful. And the second and more recent challenge was to the legislation validating some of the actions of the ICAC after the High Court had held that it exceeded its powers in conducting an investigation into Margaret Kinnean. That was also unsuccessful. The decision just came down about 10 days ago. So I probably should stop, but to go back to the start then, the things that I've talked about tonight, I hope give some idea of the material that's dealt with in the book, how it covers some aspects of legal and literary and political life in Australia over that post-war period. Writing about that period, I've noticed that we inevitably lose a great deal of historical material in Australia with the passage of time, and that's inevitable, but I've tried here to preserve a record of some of those events that I've seen or that I've written about myself. So I think I should stop at that stage, and it might be time for some questions.
Michael, it's just dropping. Okay, so we, as I said earlier, there are copies of On the Edges of History, a memoir of law, books and politics, and I'm sure Michael Sexton will be happy to sign copies after the event. Until we come to question and discussion, and once again I should say thanks to the Gallipoli Club for the use of this fine facility. So let's we've got to the top of the hour, so we've got plenty of time. Tell us a bit about Eddie McTiernan, a Labor politician from New South Wales, appointed by the Scullin Labor government to the High Court, one of the youngest judges appointed, becomes one of the oldest judges surviving, and it is rumoured that the reason for the referendum brought in 1977 to force High Court judges to retire was to stop cases like the McTiernan case. Now, I'm not sure to what extent that's mythology. I mean, how good was he when he was young, and how good was he when he was old?
Well, I think the short answer is that he wasn't much different in the two cases. The time that I was with him, he would have been perhaps getting to 80, but he was perfectly sound in physically as well as mentally. I mean, he never had a 18 months that I was with him, he never had a day's sickness, which I thought was rather extraordinary. And he was quite sort of tough, both physically and mentally. It's easy to say, and quite right to say, that he was 38, I think, when he was appointed to the court, and Ebert, who was appointed at the same time, was 36, much too young to be appointed to the bench, even now when people are being appointed younger. But there was nowhere else to go after that. Ebert did get off the court, of course, but he was a very mercurial personality. So, of course, it's unsatisfactory that someone be on the court for that length of time and to that age, although a lot of the judges did stay to a great age at that time before the referendum in 1977, and judges of the US Supreme Court are still appointed for life, and there are people there who are approaching 90 at the moment. But it's interesting that Jared should mention the referendum, because there's a consensus now, I think, in the, when I say the legal profession, the legal establishment, that the referendum was a mistake by imposing a retiring age of 70 on federal judges, 72 for state judges, but imposing this because a lot of the judges, particularly on the High Court in recent times, have come to the age of 70, and it's clear that they're completely undiminished in their capacity. But the problem about doing anything, of course, is that it would require another referendum. And the difficulties in Australia of organising a referendum, probably in terms of cost, to do it with a federal election. Once a federal election is in the wind, nobody wants to think about referendum questions. There's also other problems about, if you think of how the question would be framed, I mean, for the average member of the community, you want to increase the retiring ages of judges to, say, 75 from 70. So there's all sorts of difficulties about that, and realistically I don't think it's going to happen, at least not in the immediate future. But it's interesting that now a lot of people seem to regret that this retiring age of 70 was imposed, particularly, in my experience, federal court judges in recent years who've turned 70.
Right down the back, yes.
Just following up on Gerard's question about Smedley McKinney, Michael, he sometimes said that at various times in his career, and he was quite isolated on the court, largely for sectarian reasons. I don't know how true that is. What did you observe?
The suggestion is that Eddie McTiernan was isolated on the High Court for sectarian reasons because he was a Catholic.
Well, it certainly wasn't true when I was there. I won't go into personalities. Perhaps there were some of the judges that he got on extremely well with, some that, frankly, he didn't like much. But that was true generally of the court, that there were all sorts of likes and dislikes in relation to the individual judges. As to the earlier years, if you're looking back to the 1930s and the 1940s, there certainly were some hostilities on the court. Hayden Stark, for example, was very hostile to both Evatt and McTiernan because they'd been appointed by a Labor government, and I don't think spoke to either of them as a general proposition. So there were cross currents on the court. I assume that McTiernan got on pretty well with Justice Rich, whose associate he'd been in an earlier lifetime, and they served together on the High Court. And I think of course after when Dixon became Chief Justice. Dixon was not a person, I think, to have had any kind of sectarian views. He was a very rather ascetic character, and so I think there may have been some of that in the early days, but I think not in the long term.
Okay, there's a question down here. Yeah.
In your view, was Sir John Kerr correct in treating the deferral of supply as a refusal?
So was John Kerr correct in treating the deferral of supply as a refusal of supply?
Well, there's an academic element about this, because if as long as the opposition in the Senate maintained their position, there was going to be a problem in the medium term, and that's why I say I don't pretend that Sir John Kerr wasn't in some ways in a difficult position. If he'd waited a little longer, perhaps the opposition in the Senate or some of its members might have changed their mind. One of the problems was, of course, that on the 11th of November he was he was asked to call an election for half the Senate. I think that was a mistake on the government's part, because the half Senate election couldn't solve anything. So, as I say, I think he may have ultimately, in one sense, had to do what finally happened. But, as I say, I think the mistake was not to confront Whitlam, tell him what he thought might happen, and then things would have certainly turned out very differently for Kerr. They might have, the government may still have had to face an election, of course, and the point about that was that it was inevitably going to lose the election whenever it happened.
We go to Lindsay, then we can hear. Lindsay?
These days, the appointment of politicians to the bench is not so much frowned upon, but less and less an occurrence. It's often said that political experience improves a judge's appreciation sometimes in constitutional or other cases. Both in your office and your experience of judges who have been politicians, do you think they're improved, or your approach to matters is altered by some political background and experience?
I'll just say something generally first. I think one of the disappointing things about Australia in comparison to the United States is that there's a sense that political life is somehow unsavoury, and that people who've been involved in it shouldn't go on to other careers, and that includes the bench. I would have thought that in fact a good experience of government and politics would actually be an assistance to a judge, assuming that they have the other qualifications. And I think that's the problem now, that most lawyers who go into politics are going in like other people in politics at a very young age. They're not going to have any real experience of the law. So it follows from that that when they finish in politics, that they're probably not going to be suitable for appointment to the bench. But as a general proposition, as I say, I think that it shouldn't be a disqualification. But you're quite right, I think, to say now that that it's gone out of fashion, certainly. But partly that's because of the, as I say, because of the political careers are different now from what they were 25 and 30 years ago, in the case of lawyers.
Yes, in view of the enthusiasm for the Menzies government, and I understand Malcolm Fraser, for the Vietnam War, and do you think Fraser, at the end of his life, should have announced the changes to the war?
So the question of Malcolm Fraser's attitude to the Vietnam War at the time of the Vietnam commitment and his later life.
Well, many remarkable things about Malcolm Fraser's career. Jared and I have both had some very unkind things to say about his book. And one of the strangest aspects of it is that what emerges from the pages is that he really didn't seem to be there at all during the Vietnam period. I mean, my memory is that he was Minister for the Army. but as you say, in later years, he seemed to say that the whole thing was a terrible mistake and no one had... If I give an example, it said in his book at one point that it wasn't until 1981 when he was in Washington and someone told him that he realised that the Americans had been involved in the coup in 1963 that deposed Diem and his brother in Saigon. They were killed, of course, shortly afterwards. Well, I was a schoolboy at the time, and it was pretty obvious to me what had happened. I don't want to go into the merits of it. There was a lot of debate in Washington as to whether this would happen, and people afterwards in Washington said they never thought for a moment that the Diems would be killed, etc., etc. But no, there's a lot of very strange things about Malcolm Fraser's career, I think.
Michael, I'm wondering if you could make any comment of Justice A.B. Piddington. A.D. Piddington being appointed to the High Court, it was in the 1920s.
Yeah. I never took his place.
Okay, so there's a question about the appointment of Piddington to the High Court in about 1920. Were controversial, so he never took his place. So a bit of background on that.
Well, it probably shows you, I suppose, some of the stormy weather at the time that, that governments could run into, perhaps still, I suppose, with judicial appointments from people who'd been involved in other aspects of public life. He allowed himself, in a sense, to be forced out of it. I mean, he never took his place on the bench. There was certainly a lot of controversy, I think, when Evatt and McTiernan were appointed in 1930. Curiously, the Prime Minister Scullin and the Attorney General Brennan were in London at a conference at the time, and the two vacancies came up on the High Court, and they sent a telegram from London to their colleagues in Canberra saying, "Do not make appointment until we get back." So their colleagues went out, went straight away and made the appointments. And of course, there was quite a degree of controversy in early 1975 when Lionel Murphy was appointed to the court. And of course, Murphy turned out to be a stormy character on the court. In the book about the Whitlam government, I had a chapter on Whitlam, Kerr, Cairns, Connor and Murphy, and seem to be the central players in all of these events. And there's no doubt Murphy was a very intriguing character, very talented in many respects, but his capacity for getting into trouble was pretty extraordinary, is all I can say. In fact, the heading of that chapter, I think, was called Law and Disorder. Didn't endear me to Justice Murphy either, I think, along with a whole lot of other people that weren't endeared by the book.
Now, going back to the question, Pittington's appointed by the Hughes government, so why does he not take his position?
Well, he was criticised because of advice he'd given to the government.
So we just stepped down. Okay, question down the back.
Do you think the recent motion before the Senate in relation to the Royal Commissioner, having failed, may still cause difficulties for the Republic of Maryland? And if it had passed, would have definitely caused problems?
Well, it's certainly a very strange performance by the Labor Party, I think, to ask the Governor General to dismiss the Royal Commissioner, Dyson Heydon, given that I would have thought it was a central tenet of not just of Labor, but of all politicians in Australia, that the Governor-General would act on the advice of the government of the day. Now, the John Kerr situation was a very unusual one. It was an exercise of the reserved powers. But the example that you give, of course, the notion that the Governor-General could dismiss a Royal Commissioner without the government's advice, it's just a complete fantasy. And, of course, the people who moved the motion would have known that it was a complete fantasy. But by suggesting, I think, to the general public that could happen. Certainly very strange behaviour. I've given an example in the book that in a slightly different context, that it's been a tradition in New South Wales that the governor has on occasions relied on the advice of the, or asked for the advice of the Solicitor General. And I only use this example because it became public, but it really reflects your question that must have been in the last year or so of the previous government in New South Wales, when there was a lot of destabilised condition, premiers rising and falling every week. The governor got huge sacks of mail asking that she dismiss the government. And of course, I mean, she had to respond to these by saying that naturally it wasn't one of the things that was open to the governor. You wouldn't want to encourage, is what I'm saying, the notion that the Governor-General could exercise these kinds of powers, really. But that's what the motion was really designed to do.
We're getting very close to the end. We've got Richard.
Michael, you've made a number of references to the United States during this discussion. There is a very clear distinction between the federal and the state government's authorities there, say when it comes to raising taxes. We have the difficulty in Australia where there is this blame game between the federal and state governments. What possibility do you think there is that where the responsibility for delivering the service by the states, they should somehow or other be able to regain what was lost with the power going to the federals to be returned to the states.
Well, I think there's quite an argument to be made, although realistically, I don't think it's going to happen. What we've got at the moment, I think I mentioned it briefly, is that the financial power of the Commonwealth has become so dominant in the Federation, although it requires a lot of administrative assistance from the states in implementing its policies. So it's not completely a one-way street, but I think, and assisted by the rulings of the High Court, I think we've probably moved to a position where you can't go back, I suspect, to the position you had, say, between the wars. And although, as you point out, I mean, it's unsatisfactory in a sense that the states dependent to a large extent on Commonwealth grants and don't really have any say in the way that money's raised. And there's also the question of the distribution, as between the states and territories, of the funds that are raised, particularly from the GST. I'm very pessimistic about these things being resolved in Australia, at least in the short term.
Michael, just reverting to your time as Associate for Justice McTiernan, there were two aspects which, to certain law students, seemed to be apparent. And one was that he was determined to stay on the bench until there was another Labour government in power, so that the Labour government could appoint his successor. And the other fact which was often noted was that he was famous or notorious for two-word decisions. And either I concur or I dissent.
Let me deal with them too. The first I think is wrong. Sir Edward I got on with him very well, but he was self-centred, and I don't think he would for a moment have put his own affairs behind that of a Labor government. And if it suited him to resign, he would have resigned. It wouldn't have mattered what government was in power. That's my feeling. As to judgments, I think, particularly as time went on, I think he couldn't see on occasions the need for adding to, and indeed the whole notion of the High Court, as I've talked about in other places, but the whole notion of all these individual judgments repeating each other in large measure, instead of having some kind of joint judgments. I mean, sometimes there are joint judgments, but really all of that needs, I would say, rationalisation. But you've got seven persons on the bench who have extremely high opinions of themselves and are not going to, you know, perhaps take any orders from anyone. I remember walking down Little Bourke Street in Melbourne after court one day with Sir Garfield Barwick, and Barwick saying to me, and I imagine if he was saying it to me, he would say it to anybody, that he couldn't get any order amongst his colleagues. I mean, he tried to get some joint judgments, and I mean, they all went off, as he said, to their cells like monks and wrote these judgments, complaining bitterly to me. So to that extent, it's an old problem on the court, really.
Michael, many thanks. Michael Sexton is probably one of the more interesting Solicitor Generals we've had at the state or the Commonwealth level. I don't know how many have been busy writing memoirs and still contributing to the history debate with the background starting before that. But I'm glad Michael Sexton said today he wanted to make a contribution to history, to put stuff down before stuff is forgotten, and certainly this book has achieved that. It's a fascinating memoir across a whole range of, across a period of time, and the law and the media and politics and more besides. So I think it's worked out very well. It's been a fascinating night tonight. I don't know how many more books you'll write, but I'm sure you'll be back again. So but for tonight, well done and thanks.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.